ultimately, transformation happens at the intersection of the personal and the systemic. And it's work that's ongoing, and I think it has to be a personal and a professional journey for each of us. So we've got to examine our own self-awareness and our inclusive behaviors, and we have to use ourselves as instruments of change.
This is Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy Pace, Vice President and Global Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at MetLife. Our podcast examines the pivotal role people play in creating inclusive workplaces that are built for the future. How does inclusion impact our well-being? Why is it a business imperative? In each episode, we weave together storytelling and research-driven conversations with globally recognized authors, experts, and DEI practitioners. On the show, we tackle steps that each of us can take to advance DEI. We spend a lot of time discussing and optimizing our approach to DEI to a U.S.-based workforce. But DEI efforts are critical globally. Dr. Rohini Anand has such a unique perspective on this, both as a scholar and as a DEI practitioner. Dr. Anand served as Chief Diversity Officer for Sodexo for many years, and she's now a globally recognized author, speaker, and DEI advisor. If you don't know, Sodexo is a multinational food services company based in France. On the show, we talk about the role of a Chief Diversity Officer and how they educate leaders and transform organizations. We also talk about global DEI work. Rohini's book is titled Leading Global Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, A Guide for Systemic Change in Multinational Organizations. Rohini says her education and life experiences play a huge role in her work.
This DEI work is just very personal for anyone who does it, right? So my story is so integral to who I am. And I grew up in Mumbai, India, where almost everyone pretty much looked like me. And I belonged to the majority religion, Hinduism, and surrounded by others who looked like me. You know, I was part of the majority. I had the privilege of not having to think about my identity. So it was when I moved to the United States as a young, single immigrant woman, that was really the inflection point in my life, both literally and figuratively in my journey. And my identity shifted from being a person who saw herself as the center of her world to really being perceived as a minority, an immigrant, a foreigner, an outsider. And I was completely unprepared for that.
Rohini says her perspective changed when she came to the United States. For the first time, she was a member of a minority rather than a majority. Now, she brings this unique perspective to her work.
Understanding what it means to be perceived as an outsider, as a minority, is very much at the heart of DEI work. So for me, my work is about leveling the playing field so that everyone can succeed regardless of their identity. And today, you know, I would say I'm very fortunate, Cindy, that my vocation and my avocation are perfectly aligned.
If you aren't familiar with the word, I wasn't. An avocation is a passion or hobby.
I sort of bring to my work my own experiences, right? Both positive and negative. And I bring to my work the experience of identity being situational and shifting depending on the context. So Cindy, like you, I have my PhD. You're also a doctor. So from one doctor to another. But I actually then moved from Canada to the United States, and I went to the University of Michigan, and I did a PhD interdisciplinary. So it was history, sociology, and it was basically in Asian studies. So even my research and my PhD was really informed by my own experience. You know, it was informed by the fact that, you know, the movement of people and how identity shifts and is contextual based on what the new context and the new environment is. So it was, you know, a lot of very personal reflections that went into a case study, which was a case study from a village in India and, you know, people moving, villagers moving to the city and how their identity got reshaped.
Rohini, thanks for sharing that. I think it's so important because people are interested in understanding like the degrees that you've gotten or we've gotten. How does that inform our work? Was our research in DEI or was it, you know, tangential to the work? And so just you sharing and giving us more insight actually informs how you approach this work. So you're also, I don't know if you consider yourself this, I use this term for me, but I do think just from your background, this ability to be a scholar practitioner, to use, to understand theories and concepts and data and research, to take that and actually use it in real practice. And that's where I want to transition us now a little bit from your origin story to how did you come to DEI? And specifically, what was your journey to becoming a chief diversity officer? And not just what was the journey, but what was the work that was most important to you that you engaged in on your career journey and becoming a global chief diversity officer?
So I got my PhD. And, you know, I actually think that, you know, history, anthropology, sociology, all of these, organizational development, change, these are things that really do inform us and help us to kind of navigate the space that we're in around DE&I. You know, at the time, there was obviously no discipline that was called, a diversity discipline. So I actually taught for a while. I was sort of adjunct teaching. I was teaching overseas off and on. And then after, you know, several sort of changes, actually worked in multicultural marketing as well. So I worked at multicultural marketing at Playtex International. And, you know, that was sort of my exposure to sort of global markets, et cetera. And then landed up in a position at a nonprofit called the National Multicultural Institute and basically built up their consulting practice. And that's when I actually met the CEO of Sodexo. And I have to say that in that interview, you know, in the first 30 minutes, I had made up my mind that this is the organization I wanted to work for a couple of reasons. It's a large global organization. At the time, it had 480,000 employees. So incredible opportunity to, you know, impact people's lives. And this CEO really got it. He was very committed. And I think he made up his mind in the first 30 minutes as well.
And the rest was history. Rohini joined Sodexo and worked there for 18 years.
They had a lawsuit, and I didn't know the seriousness of this lawsuit. But about a couple of months after I joined, 6 months after I joined, it was certified as a class action lawsuit. It was a lawsuit filed by African-American employees. It was a promotion discrimination lawsuit that predated me. But clearly, you know, they wanted, you know, they'd hired me to help me to kind of change the culture. And I have to say that I had a lot of doubts initially. I kind of questioned the wisdom of the organization in hiring someone like me, who is Asian-American, not Black, not African-American, to address this lawsuit. And I have to say that if it wasn't for the generosity of spirit of my Black colleagues at that organization, I would not have been successful. I reached out to them. I didn't know what experiences they had gone through, but I was able to listen. I was able to connect. And they became my mentors, my closest allies. And together we worked through whatever the issues were. I actually say that, you know, we went from class action to best in class. Wow. Right. We went from, something that was, one of the CEOs said made lemonade out of lemons. But it took a lot of work. It took intentionality. It took commitment. It took perseverance, not just on my part, but on the part of many people in the organization.
I like how you say it, moving from class action to best in class. Is there one key takeaway? I know we're going to get into principles and things of the book, but is there one key takeaway you can share or experience from that that we can all apply that you use throughout your time, whether working specifically North America or moving to work globally in DEI?
We're dealing with resistance in organizations, right? We deal with denial. We have to, repeatedly make this business case for why DEI. I've never heard anyone make a business case, building a business case for why we need white men in certain positions, right? We're frustrated because change is not happening fast enough. But I think the one key takeaway for me is that we have to understand that organizations and individuals are at different points in the journey. And we've got to figure out strategies to influence the organization and influence leaders, particularly leaders, by meeting them where they are. But I will say that disruptive experiences, so providing those to leaders, can be very helpful. So, ultimately, I say that change happens at the intersection of people and processes. Mm. And the processes are those that we can really sort of impact your systems, et cetera. But it's a people piece and providing them with disruptive experiences. Can I share one quick story on that?
Absolutely.
So this was kind of interesting. It's a global story. So Denis Meschuel, he was one of the former CEOs at Sodexo. And, we were doing global DI work and we were focused on gender globally because that's the one thing you can measure globally. Race doesn't resonate in the same way as it does in the US and different parts of the world, etc. So I remember a meeting with Denis where he said to me, why are you diluting the focus on global gender by including other dimensions like race where it doesn't really resonate globally? And he was right. He's a white, straight French man, and he's right. And particularly in France, race does not translate. In fact, it was struck from the French Constitution, and that's a whole different discussion to be had. And you can't gather data on race, etc. So I realized that I needed to kind of expand his view, his aperture on race, and particularly in the United States and why it's important. But generally, I needed him to, get a better understanding. So I invited him to the African-American ERG meeting that we had in Texas, and he came to that meeting. He was one of the, I think, two French men in that room, one of a handful of white men in the room. And he listened to the lived experiences of the black men. What this ERG had done was just terrific. They had simulated a barber shop and a beauty parlor. So they had these two breakouts and they had, black men in one talking about their lived experiences, black women in the other talking about their lived experiences. And he attended the one with the African-American men. And he came away from that completely transformed. It was his experience of being a minority was very disruptive for him. I don't think he had been in a room full of black people before. And then second would be his experience of listening to the lived experiences of people who he knew. It got closer to home and he listened intently. He made himself vulnerable. And shortly after that, George Floyd was murdered. And he sent out this heartfelt message to the organization, which he never would have done if he hadn't had this particular experience. I think the big takeaway for me is, meeting leaders in organizations where they are, despite our frustration with things not moving fast, and being able to kind of bring them along and using sort of different techniques to do that, because, change happens at the intersection of people and systems.
I like that. Change happens at the intersections of people and systems. And you were talking about, when you were sharing to have these experiences that kind of jolt people. Mm-hmm. I call them, and this is not my terminology, but it's taken from the school of thought I came through in terms of my dissertation and my doctoral work around transformative learning. Specifically, Dr. Jack Misero designed the doctoral program that I came through, but he also designed this theory around transformative learning. The pieces about it that are so interesting is, one, creating a disorienting dilemma. And that's what you're talking about in this regard, because a disorienting dilemma actually helps someone move them from their day-to-day to become more aware of the world around them, maybe in an uncomfortable way, right? It's disruptive, as you called it, a disruptive experience, but disorienting in terms of helping you start to question, what is it that I actually know? Starting to put more of a critical filter on experiences instead of just existing in the world, it makes you critically think about your beliefs. You know, a minute ago, he was sharing with you how we shouldn't be capturing race and all of these other different backgrounds. And then he actually gets an experience of understanding the lived experience of Black people in this type of cultural microcosm of the world, the beauty shop, the barber shop, and he's forever changed. Kudos to you for, and the team at Sodexo for putting that together. Any advice on how we can, as practitioners of this work, how we can design more experiences where leaders start to critically question their existing beliefs, open up to new ways of thinking?
I think, you know, ultimately the chemistry or the trick in doing this work, as you know very well, is we all have the same initiatives, right? But it's a question of how you take what you have and really contextualize it to the organization and the people within that organization. So it's about the emotional intelligence to understand the cultural context that you're in and what's needed there. To me, it's about really understanding what a leader's ecosystem of beliefs is. And you're right, you can't tell somebody, I'm going to take you through a disruptive experience or disorienting experience. But it is about understanding their belief system and then figuring out what is going to help to move it. Okay, I'm going to share another example with you really quickly.
Awesome. I love examples.
So this one particular leader, you know, and we'd done the business case and we'd done the business case, a Sodexo business case, which was actually pretty powerful. You know, we looked, and just very quickly on that, we looked at data from 50,000 managers and over 70 different entities around the world and correlated gender balance, which was 40 to 60% women, with Sodexo's key performance indicators, which were, if I can get this right, was employee engagement, employee retention, client retention, safety, and financial outcomes. And what we found was that when you have 40 to 60% women in these management teams, they outperform those with less than 40% women. Okay. So in each one of these five performance indicators. But when you get more than 60% women, the results start plateauing off. So benefit starts getting, you know, leveling off, which basically suggests that it's not that one group is better than the other. Well, it's the mix, that optimum mix, whatever that is. So, you know, we presented all this to him and he was like, yeah, so what?
Rohini realized that what would work for this leader was personal connection.
So what I did was I got him involved in a cross-company mentoring program because it was mentoring women from different companies. So he mentored this woman, and I thought this would be a good experience because the women, he was so senior, the women internally at Sodexo may not have shared their experience, their lived experiences with him. But this woman was external to Sodexo. They built a trusting relationship. She shared her experiences. She was the only woman on the executive team. So she shared her experiences of being marginalized, of being, you know, diminished, of being talked over. And then she was let go. And she shared with him her experience of being the only woman, being let go, and what it felt like and how she had basically been sidelined and diminished. He came to me after that and he said, you know, I cannot believe that women in this day and age have these experiences in the workplace. I don't want any of the women in my organization to have these experiences.
This leader wanted other executives to have the same experience he did. He had Rohini set up a mentorship program where Sodexo's top executives mentored women from all over the company. And as a result, more of these women were promoted and took on important roles within the company.
So, you know, it had this sort of cascading effect. And this individual has gone on to become the CEO of a different organization. And today asks me to come in and, you know, help him with the work. So I think it really, to me, the one thing is, you know, we know that, you know, leadership at the top is absolutely critical. But, you know, it's how do you sort of, in addition to all the other things that chief diversity officers do, you know, the systems, the processes, the marketing, all the stuff that we're doing, how do we influence leaders in a way that really is lasting? So stop there.
I love that. And this is why, you know, when we have these conversations, it's so important to share our experiences because that's what makes DEI real. I think people are looking for some type of equation or a guidebook that tells them exactly what to do and exactly what to say. And it's really the moments that matter and making the most of those. You really taking the time to figure out what drives this individual? What motivates this individual? And as you say, meet the leaders where they are. So you've explained, you've shared several stories with us that carries immense power and influence, but you can't make people do anything, right? So it's like there's an ownership of the agenda, but the accountability and the work and the action has to be led by the organization. So when you think about the role of a chief diversity officer today, what do you think is most important for people to understand in terms of why the role exists and what do chief diversity officers do that can lead to success or progress, I'll say, in organizations? Love to hear your point of view on that.
So Cindy, you know, chief diversity officers today have this incredibly broad remit that touches every aspect in the organization, right? So obviously the talent pieces from pay equity to engagement to retention to succession planning, you know, they enable business success, right? So it's from sales and marketing and innovation and clients, et cetera. So there's, you know, they touch all those aspects. The other thing is that stakeholders are proliferated, you know, so you have your customers, your clients, your employees, and they all have influence. So if I can just digress for a second on this, I think what's happening, you know, in a big way is that the stakeholders have so much power and influence that chief diversity officers are being asked more and more to attend to, you know, the external trends that are emerging because they have a spillover effect on the workplace. So if you think about it, you know, systemic racism, right, was further magnified by the murder of George Floyd, and it accelerated the need for organizations to double down on their DEI and focus on their DEI efforts, right? So that certainly had a spillover internally that, you know, the other piece is the disparate impact of COVID on women and minorities and the political divisiveness in organizations, you know, is another huge one, which oftentimes gets divided along race lines. So I think all these things, internal and external, are things that chief diversity officers have to be attending to. And it takes tremendous amount of skill, tremendous amount of finesse. And I just think it's an underestimated position. They're transferable skills that can be transferred from a chief diversity officer to running a huge piece of business. These are the skills that you need. You know, you have to be strategic. You have to know how to position the work you're doing. You have to know how to connect it to the business. You have to understand the business. You know, you have to be able to influence, as I've talked about, bring leaders along in the face of defensiveness, backlash, right? And very often, chief diversity officers are being asked to do all of this with very little resources, with not being positioned appropriately in an organization. So you can tell I'm passionate.
I can tell. And I am sitting here just, my heart is smiling. I'm going to pick up on the point you just mentioned, strategically positioned. What advice would you give a CEO, a CHRO, any executive leader? Because that's the space where, to me, a chief diversity officer should sit, ideally direct report into or hybrid into those two functions I mentioned. What is your opinion? Because you reported into the CEO, the chief executive officer of Sodexo.
So it was interesting, Cindy. So when I was hired, I was actually reporting into the head of HR, so to the CHRO in North America. Mm-hmm. A year after that, the CEO just realized that this was much bigger than just HR talent piece. That was clearly important, critical, but was bigger. He had me report to him. So I was a peer of the chief HR officer. We partnered very closely together. My team or I would sit in the HR meetings. There was a strong connection. You know, we'd always have DEI on the HR agenda. So there was a lot of very strong alignment. Globally, I had a dotted line to the global CHRO. So I reported into the CEO, but had a dotted line. It wasn't sort of clearly verbalized, but, you know, I treated it as such because I just needed to partner with the global CHRO. So the advice, you know, I just think that having someone, first of all, it positions the individual and positions DEI for success within the organization, sends a very strong signal to the organization. I think that any discussion that's had in the C-suite can use a DEI lens, right? Whether it's workforce reductions, whether it's markets, whether it's expanding client bases, whether it is, you know, going into new markets. I think all of these can use a DEI lens. So I think there's tremendous opportunity if you look at DEI in its broadest scope, as it should be, to have that seat at the table, to be able to influence decisions that are made. The problem, Cindy, is that very often it's all performative, right? So you may have somebody who is, you know, reporting into the head of HR or reporting into the CEO, but it's just a figurehead. And I think it's incumbent on us to really create a successor pool to make sure that we are sort of, you know, passing on our knowledge to the next generation, coaching the next generation so they can step in. But I think those that take these jobs have to ask the right questions and walk away from jobs where they don't feel that they're positioned appropriately.
The organization can have the aspiration to have the role, but the role is not resourced. There's so many chief diversity officers that an officer of one, and an office of one, lack of resources, not well positioned in the organization to make an impact. And that can lead to the type of fatigue that you're talking about. And so knowing, like, what are my choices if I'm ever in this situation? How do I negotiate out of this? And one of the things you just suggested is sometimes you just have to walk with your feet. That's the biggest negotiation you're going to make, is that I won't stay here.
People are sort of saying, you know, I can't do this anymore. I don't have the resources. I'm expected to deliver these huge things. You know, the expectations are high, but, you know, my hands are tied. And I think that chief diversity officers basically need to take care of themselves, right? You know, I talked when we started talking, I talked about sort of the DEI community and just how nurturing and welcoming a place that is. You know, reach out to the community, develop your own community, you know, nurture your body and your spirit. So you have to pace yourself. You have to just say, I cannot do everything. It's okay to ask for help as well. And the other thing that I'll say is, you know, just don't take everything personally, because there's some things that will not change. There's some people that you cannot change. And ultimately, cultural transformation will either sweep them along or they'll leave.
When you look at where the role is going over the next 3 to 5 years, and a growing trend that I'm beginning to see is the expansion of the role. A couple of things, the role reporting into the CEO. Mm-hmm. That is growing. I think it's around now 30% of chief diversity officers report into the CEO. To your point, what we need to find out is, are they really strategically positioned to make an impact? Figurehead versus really a seat at the table and being able to make an impact as a member of the executive leadership team. And now I'm beginning to see that the role of the chief diversity officer is expanding and moving into the social impact ESG space. Wanted to get your thoughts on that because you had that role. Do you see that as a trend in what's happening over the next 3 to 5 years? And is there anything else that's on the horizon that we need to be aware of in terms of the role?
Yeah, I do see it as a trend. You know, I headed up corporate responsibility along with diversity, equity, and inclusion. That seems to be the practice in Europe in many organizations. I think that in the US, we're kind of evolving to that. I mean, chief diversity officers have often had some aspect of the talent portfolio, whether it's recruiting or engagement or employee value proposition, brand, etc. Marketing as well, you know, multicultural marketing. So this is an area, the S is becoming the D in ESG, absolutely. I think when I led this effort, I found that there was sort of a couple of areas where there was very clear intersections. The first was employees, because more and more employees or potential employees are concerned about organizations with purpose, and this especially Gen Y and Z. And COVID has made this even more clear. So they are looking at organizations that are leaders in ESG, which is in corporate responsibility, in diversity, equity, and inclusion primarily. The second area where I see a lot of connection is in the community. You know, for example, when you talk about corporate responsibility, you talk about sustainability and climate impact, which are the communities that are feeling the impact most acutely? These are minority communities that are plagued with pollution and with food deserts, right? So corporate responsibility has to consider DEI in the work that they do, and DEI have to partner with corporate responsibility to mitigate the impact on minority communities if we are talking about social justice and communities. Organizations that lead with purpose really communicate their brand in a holistic way, right? And that's where corporate responsibility and diversity come together to inform the brand, regardless of where functionally they report. You know, they connect the dots to tell this sort of holistic story. So I think there's a lot of connection between the two. It depends on how corporate responsibility is defined, though, in different organizations. But I do see that as an area where more and more organizations are kind of leaning in and having one individual basically have the ESG portfolio, which would include diversity and corporate responsibility, sustainability.
So there you have it. We are expanding, and you've been fortuitous in this, but one of the things that you've talked about is the ability for the chief diversity officer to take on more. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see in certain organizations where it's not just this person doing the workforce pieces, but to your point, taking on a business and other things. So more on the horizon. One last thing I wanted to say before we transition into the book, you talked about burnout. It is very mm-hmm. real, and the importance of self-care and having a sense of community. It's important to build the network, as you said, know that you can't do it alone. And you were saying you build your own community if you don't have one. So I wanted to just underscore that that is very important. Let's get to the book. I always ask this question for everyone that's listening. I just have to say that now you understand why Rohini is qualified probably more than anyone else I know to write a book on leading global diversity, equity, and inclusion. And you wrote the book saying that this is a guide for systemic change in multinational organizations. This is out now. But why this book? Why now, Rohini?
So I think a couple of things. One is, you know, I think, Cindy, for me, it was an act of closure. I actually wrote it. I started writing it in 2020, just before COVID hit. I had transitioned from Sodexo. So for me, it was an act of closure. It was an act of giving back. It was part of, you know, my legacy. And really, for me, it was, yes, you know, I talk about the principles, which I'll share in a minute, but it was really, there were these sort of two meta stories there, right? One was my own journey and my own growth as a diversity professional, because I have grown. And the second is what I wanted to share was sort of the mistakes that I had made, the learnings, the self-awareness that I had, that then I think can help others grow and learn in the process. So I think there's sort of the subtext behind the story. And then I think finally, I just was frustrated at the slow progress, particularly globally. And I wanted to share some things that might help people to speed up and to do more and inspire people to do more in the global space.
Rohini distinctly remembers going back to India to do her PhD research. She says she overlooked an important piece of the culture that was affecting women in the workplace.
So when I went back to India to do DEI work, I remember very clearly sitting in this room with about 20, 25 entry-level women managers and, you know, talking to them about advancing their careers. And I went off and talked about leadership development, mentoring, because it had been very successful in other parts of the world. And I was kind of getting no reaction, blank stares. So I spoke a couple of words in Hindi, you know, trying to kind of break the ice, signal to them that I was one of them. Still no reaction whatsoever. So I paused and I said, you know, can you help me understand what the company can do and what can be done to advance your careers? So after a pause, one of the women raised her hand and she said, you know, we live in these joint families. And if we have to stay late at work, we get chastised by our mother-in-laws. We have to go home and we have to take care of the kids and do the housework. We can't stay late for any projects. We're not able to really sort of advance the work that we're doing, even though we'd like to. And I was, and with that, you know, everyone started chiming in and sharing their experiences. And I was really at a loss because I'm thinking to myself, I said, okay, so what do you want the company to do? So I asked them again, I said, how can we help? So one of the women raised her hand and said, you know, what you can do is to have a recognition day and invite our extended families. So we did that. We had this, you know, it was one of the highlights of my work there, recognition day where they, you know, the extended families came, the mother-in-laws, we gave them awards, the women awards, and the mother-in-laws were so proud of their daughter-in-laws. Now, did it change the dynamic at home? I don't know. Maybe they came home to a hot meal, but if they had to stay late at work for something, it wasn't such a huge issue. So for me, that was an aha moment, was really a learning because I had completely forgotten this sort of multi-generational joint family dynamic in India. And I'd forgotten the role of the Indian woman as a mother, as a wife, but also as a daughter-in-law. And honestly, Cindy, I'd forgotten my own limitations as a multidimensional being because I was so focused on sort of this one aspect of our shared identity with these women that I had forgotten all those other differences.
Rohini's book focuses on global DEI efforts and tailoring your approach based on location and culture.
So these are the kinds of lessons, early lessons that really taught me that it's not useful to export initiatives globally that have worked in one part of the world. And the second thing it taught me was that I really needed to check my presumptions. So, you know, we talked about disrupting leaders' worldviews, but we also have to disrupt our own worldviews to bring about transformation in ourselves. So I'm very, very candid and make myself pretty vulnerable about sort of the mistakes that I made along the way in the hopes that others don't repeat the same mistakes in the book. So that's why I wrote the book. It's, you know, it's more for me, it's my way of giving back.
Well, thank you for writing the book. And if you could just summarize for us, you know, people are going to go out and get the book. If you could take us through one or two principles that stand out for you that could be a call to action for CDOs, for practitioners leading this work, what would those two principles be that could help guide them into progress?
So just a couple of points here, right? First, you know, I think given sort of the complex and dynamic nature of global DEI work, there's really no checklist, there's no playbook. And best practices, as you said yourself earlier, are not enough, right? And I think that's been one of those foundational mistakes, that to replicate what's worked in one part of the world in another part of the world. Just, you know, one story on that, one particular organization I worked with, they did this global race training, right? And they wanted to roll it out globally. It really didn't resonate. And one of the women said to me, and this is again an example from India, she said, you know, one of the activities had these hot buttons, and the hot buttons that they chose were gun control and abortion, which obviously are hot buttons for us in the US. But in this part of the world, she said, these two hot buttons don't resonate because we don't have guns and abortion is legalized. So there's no hot button issue here. But the hot button issue for us is divorce. You know, this is one of those sort of mistakes that we made, that we can export things. So I do have these five principles, and I won't go into all of them, but they provide a through line. They're simple and disruptive. And the main thing is that they don't provide, as you said, sort of standards and plug and play templates based on what's worked, you know, in the US. Ultimately, transformation happens at the intersection of the personal and the systemic. And it's work that's ongoing. And I think it has to be a personal and a professional journey for each of us. So we've got to examine our own self-awareness and our inclusive behaviors. And we have to use ourselves as instruments of change.
I love that. That's our call to action, to be the change that we want to see. We have to be it. And so take those steps, get the book, and that'll be our guide to how we can have more effective systems around change. Thank you, Rohini. This has been amazing. And I look forward to us connecting again soon. Thank you all for joining me on this episode of Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. You can learn more about Dr. Rohini Anand at rohinianand.com. At MetLife, we are committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we believe making a difference in the lives of our customers, community, and the world around us is altogether possible. Learn more and join us at MetLife.com. The link is in our show notes. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope you also take the time to rate and leave our show a review. Before we go, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, Human Group Media, who helped us produce this show. That's it for today's episode. I hope you join me in the next one.